Jewish World, a podcast by the World Jewish Congress, Israel. Connecting Israel to Jewish communities around the world.
Hello and welcome to the maiden episode of Jewish World, a podcast by World Jewish Congress, Israel in Jerusalem. My name is Efrat Sofer, and I'm proud to be associated with the World Jewish Congress, the representative body of Jewish communities in over 100 countries worldwide. Since 1936, our mission has been to serve world Jewry and to represent Jewish communities. We act as both the parliamentary and diplomatic arms of the Jewish people, in accordance with the Talmudic dictum, Kol Yisrael Arevim Ze Baze. All Jews are responsible for one another. That means ensuring both the well-being of Jews, but also ensuring Jewish continuity. Much of our activity, sadly, is focused on combating anti-Semitism, racism, and attempts to circumscribe Jewish civil rights as well as religious rights. And today, curiously, a subject which I never thought I'd be commenting on is sports. The world of sport has often been seen as a reflection of society. A recent and especially noteworthy example was the World Cup in Qatar. That tournament shed light on a variety of political agendas, some of which were honestly quite disturbing. Today, we will be discussing the phenomenon of anti-Semitism and hate in international sports. With us are two extraordinary guests who have very graciously agreed to share their time and insight. Israeli race walker Shaul Adani has had the unfortunate fortune of surviving two experiences where his identity was targeted. First and foremost, the Holocaust, and then, decades later, the Munich Olympics massacre. Adani, now 86 years old, survived as a child the Nazi bombing of his family home in Belgrade in the former Yugoslavia, fled with his parents to Hungary, hid in a monastery, but was captured and sent to Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. In 1944, he was saved with his parents via the Kassner train, and eventually, in 1948, at the age of 12, arrived in Israel. During World War II, he lost his grandparents, who were killed in Auschwitz. With a second degree in engineering and a PhD in business, Adani became a professor at the Ben-Gurion University, while also developing a career as a marathon runner and later as a race walker. After winning numerous international competitions, Adani received the Pierre de Coubertin Medal for the promotion of Olympism. His 50-mile speed walking world record, set in the early 1970s, wasn't broken until 2021. Adani was also part of the Israeli delegation to the 1972 Olympic Games in Munich. He wore the Star of David on his shirt and said that he wanted, quote, to show the Germans that a Jew had survived. Adani was staying in apartment 2 in the Olympic Village when, in the early hours of September 5th, 8 armed Palestinian members of Black September organization, a part of the PLO, broke in, shot and killed some of the Israeli athletes, and took the others hostage. Adani and one of his roommates managed to escape through the back door, run to a nearby building, and woke the American team, who alerted the police. Adani is the protagonist of the documentary The Survivor, the latest film by 11 Emmy Award winner, American sports writer, television reporter, and author Jeremy Shapp. Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jeremy, your reputation precedes you. You've written several books, among them Triumph, The Untold Story of Jesse Owens, and Hitler's Olympics, directed a short documentary film about Beitar Jerusalem, and created several ESPN shows, including E60, Outside the Lines, and SportsCenter. The Survivor focused on Adani as a way of telling the story of the Munich massacre in a way that's relatable to a young audience who is not really familiar with the events. Making the film, Shapp traveled to Israel and Germany and conducted an 8-hour-long interview with Adani. Jeremy, you're quoted as saying, meeting a man who saw it with his own eyes and could tell me the story from his own personal experience was very meaningful for me, because I'm Jewish. You say that every step Ladani has taken since the Holocaust was an act of defiance. Do you think that there's something inherently violent in sports? Not on the field, but around it, an emphasis on nationalism or a hatred towards the other team, which manifests as a rivalry with the opposing team supporters, etc.?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, from the North American perspective, right? I live in North America. I cover mostly sports in North America, although, as you mentioned, I've covered Olympic Games and World Cups and international events. Violence is not something that I think is inherently part of our sports culture. When we're talking about, I'm not talking about on the field or on the court or on the rink. I'm talking about in the stands. You know, it's different over here. The kind of, you know, ultra fans that you see, especially in soccer in Europe, we don't have in North America. Fan violence, although it does exist here, is rare. I would say, you know, We see violence, of course, in sports, at big events around the world, not only when it's national teams competing against each other, but when, you know, there are rivals who are competing against each other. You know, some of the rivalries that, you know, you get in international soccer between, you know, opposing teams in the same city or in the same region, that lead to these, you know, horrible incidents where fans really feel entitled to attack each other physically. You know, fortunately, as I said, here in the U.S., that's not something we really experience. So I can't say that it's just baked into sports. I think it's different, you know, depending on the context, depending on where you are around the world.
It's really interesting that you say that, because being based here in the UK, and soccer has had moments of violence, as have in Europe. What about racism and anti-Semitism? Has that been manifested within sports in the US?
I would say that, you know, when we talk about racism that we still see in arenas around the world, you know, some of the horrible stuff, and I did a story of this nearly two decades ago, racism at the highest levels of European soccer, the terrible abuse that especially Black players were subjected to. We don't see, I'm not even sure it's right to say we don't see as much of that. We don't see that in North American major sports. I mean, it happens, of course. You know, there is racism, of course, that spills into our sports world, that spills into arenas, and players are subjected to it, and we see it. But the kind of constant abuse that we witness, I remember, you know, Samuel Eto'o in particular was very outspoken. He had endured so much when he was playing in Barcelona, the Cameroonian soccer player. That kind of horrible stuff, you know, that you saw a lot of in Europe 20 years ago. And I'm not sure. I think somewhat to a lesser degree now, that kind of blatant racism is certainly less commonplace in North American professional sports. In terms of anti-Semitism, you know, it's different too. You know, there are teams that are historically associated with Jewish fan bases, whether it's Ajax in Amsterdam, Tottenham in London, where, you know, when the teams travel, there are anti-Semitic chants in the stadiums, et cetera. And then, you know, when teams from Israel compete, you know, there you can see anti-Semitism manifesting itself. But in the U.S., you know, there aren't a lot of incidents. I'm trying to think of any, you know, that are similar to that. And frankly, nothing really springs to mind. Now, if you go back in history, decades, I mean, the kind of racist abuse that Jackie Robinson, who was the first African-American player in Major League Baseball in the 20th century, what he had to endure, what Jewish players decades ago had to endure. You know, that was certainly much more prevalent decades ago.
It's amazing that you mentioned context as well, that we've, and this is probably an arena where governments or hosts of anything sports related can play some sort of steering role, I guess, where in Qatar, for example, we saw Israeli fans being allowed into Qatar to watch the games. So your mentioning of context is fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it depends where you are, what the teams are involved. Are we talking about fans? Are we talking about, you know, are we talking about actions by players themselves? You know, and I don't want to by any means minimize, you know, what we still see in North America in sports. And I know we've done many stories, particularly about Black athletes and what they face, what they have to deal with. And you see it at all levels, from the highest level of the professional leagues to colleges, high schools, minor leagues. It is definitely still there. But when you see, you know, what sometimes happens overseas, as we say, when you see the kind of mass expressions of racism in these arenas, it's stunning. And you know, there's just a different way, I think, when we talk about the really ugly stuff in international sports. You mentioned, you know, national passions and rivalries. And the way that people support, if that's the word you want to use, their national teams outside of the U.S. is perhaps different. There's a longer history of caring about sports in which you're constantly competing against regional or continental rivals, whereas most of the focus historically in the U.S. to a much greater degree is on our domestic leagues.
If we could pivot a little to your amazing film. In your film, you told the story of the 1972 massacre through the extraordinary life and experiences of Shaul Adani, a Holocaust survivor. Do you think that the Munich events were actually anti-Semitic? They were directed against Israel, so is it not possible to define them as plainly political rather than racist?
I think that's a complicated question, right? As you said, you know, anti-Semitism versus anti-Zionism. You know, what was going on? Now, clearly, you know, the targets were Israelis, and they were Israeli Jews. They weren't Jews from other countries. Clearly, a statement was being made about Israel. But as you said, the way that anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism are inextricably linked is something that we have to, you know, take into account as well. I'm, you know, not a scholar of these kinds of things. I'm a sports reporter. Where you draw the line between what is an anti-Semitic act and what is an anti-Zionist act, I'm not exactly sure. I know that Shaul Adani, the subject of our film, you know, who was a survivor of the Holocaust and came to Israel shortly after the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, who fought, you know, in its wars. You know, he would think of it all as being wrapped up together. As you said, anti-Zionism being tantamount to anti-Semitism. But it's complicated.
If we were to add another layer to this complication, the terrorists were Palestinians, and some would erroneously, in my view, argue that their agenda was not anti-Jewish, but very much connected to the Israeli-Palestinian ongoing conflict. How would you respond to that?
Well, it certainly was, you know, related to the conflict. The fact that, you know, Black September was targeting Israeli Olympic athletes, you know, it goes back to the, you know, conflict, of course, which at that point, you know, had been raging for decades and continues to rage now, half a century later.
But we're speaking about something that happened in Germany.
You know, I guess the question is, for some, would be, is this a legitimate expression of the conflict? And to me, athletes competing at the Olympic Games in Germany, representing their country, unarmed, asleep in their rooms, in their dormitory, you know, what happened was a crime. They were massacred. German police officer also died at the field. You know, I'm sure on the other side, from the Palestinian side, the argument would be, you know, these are mostly young men. Many of them are serving in the military when they're home, and that makes them a legitimate target. And to raise awareness of our cause, that makes it a legitimate target. To me, what happened there was simply a crime. But certainly that's from a different point of view than the Palestinian point of view. The world reacted, of course, in a way that said this was wrong. And again, I'm not a scholar of the conflict between Palestine and Israel. What happened in Munich 50 years ago was terrible.
And you're kind of showing this, what happened and the atrocity, through the eyes of Shaul Adani, I think really highlighted the atrocity and the targeting of Jews, that we follow Shaul's journey through surviving the Holocaust and those horrendous atrocities. And there he is once again targeted. There he is once again having to flee for his life, is something that really encapsulates the horror of it all.
Yeah.
And that's why he was such an extraordinary person to highlight.
That's right. You know, the director I worked with, Frank Saracino, my colleague at ESPN, you know, we wanted to look back at what happened 50 years ago because it was such a horrific event, an important event, and it changed the way we look at sports. It changed the way we look at the Olympics. It changed the way that we attend sports events in terms of the security that's been built up since then, the atmosphere around big international sports events. And the story of Munich, the massacre, has been told many times, but, you know, a story we didn't know. And as you said, you know, I've covered a lot of Olympics. Frank knows a lot about sports history and Olympic history in particular as well. And we didn't know the Shaul Adani story. I didn't know who he was, although I know that he is a much more familiar figure in Israel, obviously, than he is in the United States, especially for an older generation that was alive at the time of some of his more extraordinary athletic exploits. The fact that he was a Holocaust survivor, and he was also a survivor of this horrific event, you know, there were these layers to his story that we thought would make him a very interesting subject. And it was also a perspective on Munich, on the massacre, that we hadn't heard before from one of those Israeli delegation members, one of those Israeli athletes who was there, who was in the building at 31 Connolly Strasse, but survived. You know, I've, you know, we've seen documentaries before about what happened on that horrible day. We've certainly heard a lot from the families of those who died, figures in government who were involved in what happened that day. But I hadn't heard from one of the athletes who was there that morning.
Which is what makes your viewpoint so extraordinary. We will return to Jeremy later in the podcast.
You're listening to Jewish World by the World Jewish Congress, Israel.
Our second guest, Daniel Lerscher, is the special envoy for combating discrimination with the Borussia Dortmund Soccer Club. He's also the founder of What Matters, a non-profit organization that focuses on Holocaust remembrance, combating anti-Semitism, and fostering Jewish life in the areas of sports, corporations, and other organizations. He oversees the club's anti-discrimination programs for fans, employees, and sponsors since 2013. And has initiated visits of Borussia Dortmund's team, BVB's players, employees, and fans to Auschwitz since 2011. Lerscher, who studied to become an insurance manager, was an avid fan of Borussia Dortmund, which led to his hiring by the club to set up an anti-discrimination program. And as he says, "And it just grew until I became immersed in the topic. We realized we could address fans via the club and do programs with them together." Daniel, it's such an honor and a pleasure to have you join us.
Yeah, hi from my side, and thanks for having me, Efrat. It's a huge pleasure to be here.
Is it something that other football clubs in Germany or in other places are engaged with? Or does it have anything to do with BVB having quite a few foreign players? This whole issue of racism awareness?
I would say that especially since 2016, the German Football League focused very much on educating the supporter liaison officers in doing their own programs with their football supporters, which was also initiated somehow by Borussia Dortmund and supported by us and our work. But due to this, many other clubs also started programs to remember persecuted football players of their club, remember persecuted Jewish people of their city. And out of this, a youth program started in different German football clubs. And it's really good that there's no competition at all. It's really a huge exchange of knowledge and advising each other. And helpful. And the DFL, the German Football League, is overseeing all these activities and is setting also their own programs in this field. So this is the one answer. And the second answer is that, of course, the football field is a very diverse place. One could see players from different countries, from different cultural backgrounds. And I think from my perspective, football is one of the most diverse parts in society where it's really visible that people with different backgrounds play together in the same game, and it's quite easy for everybody to attend. Even though you can't play, you can talk about it and can discuss about it.
It's actually quite amazing how at first glance, when one thinks about football and sport, it's something that we do recreationally and in our spare time, and one wouldn't necessarily consider the layers of different aspects that do play out within sport in general and football in particular. And your programs look like they really do tackle head on the different issues that do come up. Again, what sort of problems were your programs supposed to address?
The program is under the umbrella of United by Borussia, and the idea was to use, United of Borussia is a part of a very famous song about the club, which says that United by Borussia, there are men, women, different religions, different countries, and this is the umbrella of our work. And under this umbrella, we then address directly if we see an incident, which is a racist incident or an homophobic incident or an incident in the case of sexism, we address it directly and say United in Borussia, by Borussia, United against racism, for example. But it also helps us to have the umbrella work and to, if we, for example, do our Holocaust remembrance and education programs, there's always a multi-perspective on different forms of discrimination. So we are able to talk about anti-Semitism, but we are also able to talk about racism, about the persecution of Sinti and Roma, for example. And it's quite a good chance to use just the identification of football supporters with their hometown and with the club's hometown and with their club to address them and to talk about different perspectives. And then also in the group of participants, there's always a diversity. So one could see different people, very high educated people, normal workers, different people just came together. The framework of this is then the club. They are all able to talk about for example, the upcoming superstar in the midfield or the next forward, but also about the questions they are facing in the society. And it's really interesting to bring this then together and have very, very deep programs and tough discussions about the topics, but always with an exchange and always with open-minded people, because the club is somehow lighting them in this direction.
And how did the fans initially react? Because it's a lot of depth to the program.
Yeah, it's there were different reactions, to be honest. I would say, like, the first initiative really came by supporters, and they did the first programs against racism and against discrimination. And it was then brought to the club, and the club took over this clear statements in this field. And now it's really working hand in hand. But of course, there are also supporters which are really not happy about that. We have had when Borussia Dortmund donated to Yad Vashem in 2019, there were members who quitted their membership at the club. And we as a club then decided to say, okay, it's good if they quit, because if they don't can confirm on our values, it's even better if they don't support us anymore. And I think on the one hand, it was important to have this clear statement, but on the other hand, it was really important to really stand clear to our values when it comes then to real reactions. And the most of the supporters are quite open to it and support it. And I think a football club can really be an institution that gives orientation in this field and that creates values without creating party politics.
I guess it took a lot of bravery on behalf of the leadership of the team to allow the detractors to kind of fall away. And I understand that many people wish to take part in the Auschwitz visits, so much so that you actually had to turn people down. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, of course. It's kind of the lighting towers, or I don't know what, one of the most important programs we have every year. And we now do it since 2011, and we visiting the memorial site in Auschwitz, but also places that are not connected to the memorial nowadays, but that were connected to the camp Auschwitz, to concentration camp Auschwitz in the wartime. We visiting Oświęcim for 7 days with our supporters, and they pay just 50 euros to participate. It's an open call for participation. Every supporter can apply. And what turns out is that the interest is so huge that we aren't able to handle it anymore, because we have about 120 to 150 applications for about 30 participants. So the program starts in Dortmund, and we are looking at places that we usually pass by in our normal life, but we don't know, or one don't know, what happened there back in the Second World War time. So for example, the train station, former train station where the Jews from Dortmund were deported from, is now more or less just a construction site. One couldn't see anything there anymore without a small pledge, but people just pass by car and don't know what kind of places are connected there. But we also have the Stepling Stones in Dortmund, for example, where many supporters clean them every year in front of houses of persecuted Jews and killed Jews in the Shoah. So there are connection points, but then for us, it's very important to go the next step and talk not just about, like, they were brought to Auschwitz, but also visiting then Auschwitz and start the program on the former ramp where the Jews arrived, especially the Jews from Dortmund, and then bring it to a wider view and talk about the history of the camp, the perpetrators in the camp, who were responsible, who were all needed to create this this crime, and also have a view on histories and stories of victims, but also survivors and the different people that were in Auschwitz, the different groups that were, like, the groups created by Nazis. And so giving the supporters a huge view on on this topic. This is like from the historical side or from the side of education, very important to understand what happened in the past. But also for us, it's very important to talk to the group of supporters in this week and to, like, in every program, people are asking, how would I have behaved back in 1940 to 1945? And we always turn it around and ask them, okay, it's the wrong question, because we know the end. We know what happened. We know we are very well informed and educated. But what is necessary to ask is, how do we behave, and how do we behave as a club and as supporters? And we all together, how do we behave nowadays, and how, what impact can we create, in the small field of sports, but then even beyond, because we are all part of the society. And this is very, very interesting, to bring these people together in this situation and create such, more or less safe spaces where people really can ask questions, where people can discuss with others they don't know before. And the only common thing is that they all have, love for the same club. And this is really interesting to see. And the interest is huge. And we have this program in Auschwitz, and we have it like for supporters, but we also have a 4-day program for employees and the employees of our sponsors. So we really also involve the area of sponsors, which are more important nowadays in football than before. And we also have a program in the not so well-known places, like the more or less forgotten places of the Holocaust. And we are visiting Eastern Poland, especially with a special view on one deportation from Dortmund to Zamość. And we are visiting the memorial sites in Belzec and in Sobibor. But also former ghettos and, have a look there. And it's not, like Auschwitz is really known by everybody, but for us, it's also important to have a few on the sites that are not that well known.
What's extraordinary, that comes to mind to me is how your club has such huge knock-on effects, where it really is the epitome of think globally, act locally. In that you're really creating this safe space for your club and your supporters and your sponsors and your employees is to first of all raise awareness, to make them aware of the fact that atrocities can happen anywhere unless we are aware. They can happen in the most everyday places, like a train station. And to see the knock-on international effect of what you're doing. And personally, I think it should be a prototype of to many, many other clubs. Can you yourself feel the effect of those programs beyond the football pitch?
It's difficult to measure, to be honest. But I really think that football clubs have the possibility to create change and to be part, a positive part of the society. So if Borussia Dortmund is doing a statement on social media, it's seen by millions of people. And these people are all parts of different parts of the society. So they all belong to society, and they all see kind of an, like we can, in common, we can create a change. And I see it that from this perspective, it's really important that football clubs don't see it just as sport clubs. It's even more at the moment from my perspective. And on the other hand, I also see it when it comes to person of color or when it comes to Jewish people. If they see there is a club who is doing something like that, and like the sign from the club is that you can feel welcome here, and here's a place where you can be without fear. And I think this is important as well. So like in two directions, and one could also add a third direction, the direction of offenders and perpetrators, like your behavior is not welcome here. And if you behave like that, you don't belong to us. So this is like from my perspective, quite clear that if clubs do clear statements and when it's really not just statements and one could really feel it, it can create a change. And what we can see is that people are attending our events, and they are so different. And it's so interesting to see that schoolers and elderlies, and like we are not focusing only on young people, because we can really address every age group. And this is so interesting because very often when we see problems, or when one see problems, people always say, we must educate the young people. But especially due to Corona, one could see that it wasn't young people demonstrating with anti-Semitic narratives on the streets. It was people in the age of 40, 50 or 60. So I think football has a really powerful situation there. And it's a responsibility out of this.
The sense of responsibility is extraordinary. And the role that education plays in it is so amazing, in that we may even have a situation where the young people can model for the older generations what is acceptable and what is not acceptable anymore. And that's thanks to you.
Thank you. What is really important to me to point out is that for me, our Holocaust educational programs, or in general, Holocaust education, to learn about different forms of discrimination, about anti-Semitism, is not something like a wonderful vacation on a wonderful island, which one has on his bucket list, and he just need to cross it once, and then it's done for the whole life. It's more like to learn about it, to renew and to refresh what once was learned about it, and to create a safe space or a space where people can discuss things like that. This would really solve problems and really helps to create a common understanding on how we would like to live together and how we create a positive future for everybody. This would really solve a lot of things. This is, important for me to point out.
We're back with Jeremy Schapp. Here's another clip from The Survivor, his documentary about the Israeli race walker Shaul Adani.
Only one Israeli survivor has long been critical of the decision to leave.
Wrong decisions. I argued that the Israeli flag decorated with the black should parade at the closing ceremony.
Following the massacre, the Olympic Committee decided, very controversially, to resume the Games. Jeremy, do you think that was the right decision?
I think that's a tough one. Now, certainly, at the time, there were so many voices, important voices, who thought it was the wrong decision to continue the Games after, I think, it ended up being about a 24-hour break. I remember the Games didn't even get paused until late in the afternoon after the hostages had been taken and two Israelis had already been murdered. And then they had a memorial service the next morning, and then it was sometime later that afternoon where competition resumed, I think. It seems to me that the better thing to do would have been to say, enough. This is enough. After what has happened here, we cannot go on. We cannot continue to play these games. I think that would have been the right and the humane decision. Interestingly, as you know, having seen the film, Shaul doesn't feel that way.
That was amazing, and one of the most striking parts for me of the film, when Shaul talks about following the Munich massacre. That was one of the most striking parts of the whole film.
Right, and I was surprised when, I read it in his memoir, and then, said, well, this is something obviously we have to talk to him about. The idea never occurred to me, frankly, that anyone who was part of the Israeli delegation would have felt that the Israelis should have stuck around after what happened and continued to compete and to have marched in the closing ceremony several days later. That tells you so much about who Shaul Adani is. And I think it probably tells you a lot about people of his generation in Israel as well, especially survivors. Especially people who came over after the Holocaust in Europe, in the late 1940s, early 1950s, whatever it might have been, and were part of building this young state of Israel, and who felt that whatever the challenges might be, whatever obstacles were put in their path, you keep going. And with Shaul, that's also, you know, a metaphor for what he literally does as an athlete, you know, a race walker. The longest races at the Olympics, the 50-kilometer walk, you know, more than 30 miles, where you just keep going. And to hear him talk about that, you know, that he thought going home was surrender, that was powerful.
I still hold up today that our retreat was totally wrong. I never retreat.
Absolutely. And for me, visually, the part where he said that the Israeli flag should have been in the closing ceremony with a black, I think he said a black ribbon or a black something. Just, I guess, in a way, he said that we mustn't hide and we just keep going, which was very, very inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's who he is, right? You keep going.
Amazing. And since you know Shaul so well, do you think that Shaul would still believe that sports can bring different people together?
Oh, 100%, as we say, 100%. I'll say this about Shaul. One of the most interesting things I thought that he said, which closes the film, I say, you know, people, when they hear a story, they say, well, how did you keep getting up every morning? How do you get up every morning after all that you've seen, all that you've been through, all of these nightmares? And maintain, I mean, this is too weak a way of putting it, positivity. You know, it's more than positivity. It's inspirational the way that he keeps going, amassing achievements. And he said he's able to do it because he's able to, let me put it the right way. I don't want to put words in his mouth. What he said was because he does not hate. He's able to not allow the bad things that he's seen, that he's witnessed, that have happened to him to ruin the rest of his life, that he can go on. And in terms of sport, how I'm connecting it back to that, is that, you know, Shaul went all over the world before and after Munich to compete as an Israeli, all over the world as an elite race walker. And he made friends everywhere he went. You know, he went to Germany all the time after having been in a concentration camp in Germany in his youth. He goes, you know, he's made friends all over the world. He believes, if anyone believes in the power, the positive power of sport, of bringing people together from different countries, from different races, from different religions, from different societies, I would think that it's Shaul. And he has this network of friends all over the world who, you know, he's remained in touch with for, you know, since the 1960s. You know, he's 86. He's been doing this, traveling all over the world. I don't know how many miles he's flown all over the world, competing in events, but it's a lot. And, you know, he has this, I don't know how active it is now that he's 86, but for a long time, you know, he was in opposition. He was at odds with the Israeli sports establishment and the track and field establishment. And a lot of it was about, you know, they're not supporting him the way that he felt he should be supported, especially financially. And you know, they wouldn't send him where he wanted to be sent. You know, they're like, oh, it's just race walking, right? Well, he's pretty good. And as far as I know, he's the first Israeli world champion in any athletics event, or as we say here, the U.S. track and field event. And so he felt they treated him with disrespect. And part of that is because he wanted to continue to, you know, compete and to see the world and to meet other people. And he's someone who, because of his unique character and energy, has maintained these friendships.
It's absolutely extraordinary. And thank you so much for introducing us to him. If I may, just one final question.
Sure.
Since we're dealing with kind of today's challenges and issues in sports. How do you think Shaul would respond to the presence of anti-Semitism and racism in sports today? What would be his approach to battling it within the sports field?
Well, I think it's his approach to battling it anywhere that he confronts it. Racism, anti-Semitism, is to call it out, is to confront it, not to minimize it. You know, that's always been his philosophy. And that's why, you know, he's written a book. That's why he lectures, you know, all over the world. That's why he agreed to do this film, because the message of his life is that you must stand up to hate. And you can't let it destroy you, but you have to confront it. You can't ignore it when it exists and it's there. You call it out. And I think, I know that's, you know, what he believes. You know, when he went back to Munich for the 50th anniversary, for the commemorations, you know, he's there. You know, he's doing these things, he's traveling, he's going to these places because he understands the importance of making people aware of what happened so that it doesn't happen again.
And may he continue to do so, and may his legacy of building friendships and connections as a true survivor go from strength to strength. I would like to sincerely thank both of our guests for joining us. Daniel, thank you so much to you and to your club for truly being a lighthouse in this area and for being a model. And this is something that clubs around the world would do well to see you as an inspiration. Thank you so much for all of your work and for joining us and for shedding light on all of the brilliant initiatives that you have and the change that you're making.
Thank you, Everett. It was my pleasure to be here.
Jeremy, thank you so much for introducing us properly to Shaul and for joining us today and for creating your beautiful film.
Thank you so much for the kind words.
And I would like to thank you for tuning in and invite you to join us and subscribe to the WJC podcast series. I'm Efrat Sofer. Thank you so much.
Jewish World, a podcast by the World Jewish Congress, Israel. Jewish World is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon, and more. Subscribe for updates on new episodes.